Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the 20th anniversary University of Chicago Roundtable. To open today's program, we present Alan Simpson, chairman of the Faculty Board of Radio of the University of Chicago.
On Sunday morning, February the 1st, 1931, three professors of the University of Chicago gathered around an old-fashioned carbon microphone to discuss the Wickersham Report on Prohibition. From that moment, there began the first regularly scheduled educational program in the history of radio. It was christened the Round Table, after a certain well-known table in the dining room of the faculty club. Today is the 20th anniversary of that Sunday morning. In establishing the Round Table, the University of Chicago seized upon a new means of fortifying an old ideal. The undertaking was ambitious, but the principles involved were clear. First, radio was a unique and massive instrument for molding the American mind. Second, it was the duty of a university to use this instrument as a means of universal education. Third, its platform should provide a hearing for the best available talent inside and outside the national community. It should seek to unite all the resources of leadership in a joint examination of our problems, our hopes, and our failures. Fourth, this platform should try to provide a model for every form of purposeful discussion in which free and responsible men engage. Lastly, acting in the image of the educational ideal, no principles of exclusion should be admitted except the principle which denies a hearing to passion, dishonesty, and incompetence. There would be no axe to grind, no censorship, open or concealed. These principles have never been sacrificed to widen the hearing or to solicit any interest narrower than the best interest of the American people. Yet the hearing has widened year after year, and the Round Table has won both the confidence of a national network and the loyalty of the stations which it serves. It is today the most widely heard program of its kind. The role of America's universities in radio and of radio in American life has been defined by Robert M. Hutchins as follows: to formulate, to clarify, to vitalize the ideals which should animate mankind is the heavy burden which rests upon the universities. The task of the Round Table is candid and intrepid thinking about fundamental issues. Free discussion is a necessary condition of a free society. Where men cannot freely convey their thoughts to one another, no freedom is secure. Where freedom of expression exists, the beginnings of a free society and a means for every extension of liberty are already present. On this anniversary date, the Round Table will discuss one of the most vital issues confronting Americans today, the issue of national security and individual freedom. To introduce our program, we first present, by transcription, the Honorable Adlai Stevenson, Governor of Illinois.
The topic of today's roundtable, national security and individual freedom, seems to me most appropriate because this is the 20th birthday of the roundtable. The University of Chicago has maintained this tradition of free discussion for 20 years of continuous broadcasting. And I wish I could have participated personally in this roundtable discussion because the appointment this past week by President Truman of the Commission on Internal Security and Individual Rights, headed by Admiral Nimitz, reminds us again that we have failed miserably to find a way to protect ourselves against treason, sabotage, and other subversive acts on the one hand, without destroying our traditional liberties on the other. The enormously important problem the President has assigned this commission is, in short, to seek the widest balance that can be struck between security and freedom. It is high time, indeed I think it is past time, for a reasoned, impartial, objective study of the closely related subjects of national security and individual freedom. There have been too many wild, irresponsible accusations of disloyalty. The dreadful concept of guilt by association has been added to our language. The slander is honored. The shadow of suspicion and fear slopes across our land. There is even talk of thought control among Thomas Jefferson's people. Fear for the integrity of one's good name and the security of one's job has spread like a pall through government, stifling initiative and depriving us of valuable manpower. On the other hand, this is a national emergency. The world, the free world, that we have known is in danger. Believing as we do in a community of free nations and of free peoples acting peacefully and responsibly through governments freely chosen, we conclude at last that we cannot live in comfortable security with a great imperial power which has seen the barriers to its expansion collapse and is on the move again, taking here, probing there, and pressing relentlessly against the uncommitted, discontented millions of the earth. Capitalizing the zeal to missionize the world of the Russian people, the leaders of the new Russia, armed with force and the old weapon of fomented revolution, use this seductive new weapon of communism to soften their victims. But whatever the trappings, the methods, the weapons, the objective is domination, imperialism. And America, rich, peaceful, and undisciplined, now finds itself face to face with this inscrutable, ruthless conqueror, strong, cunning, and armed with an egalitarian idea that has great appeal for the miserable masses of humanity. No longer is there anyone to protect us. No longer can we sow when and where we are certain to reap. There is no safe investment, no certain harvest any longer. So we've concluded at last that we must rearm and help all our like-minded friends to rearm. We have concluded that the balance of power in the world must once again be redressed. We have concluded that the free world, to continue free, must stand fast against aggression and must hastily confront imperial communism with a preponderance of power. Against that backdrop of danger, a group of sane, responsible men have been assigned the task of diagnosing this national neurosis, the fear of subversive activity within our gates, and to prescribe for an affliction that has been aggravated by the very genuine, indeed the mortal danger from without. The important goal, as most objective observers agree, is to achieve some sanity and balance in an area of our national thinking that is dangerously out of balance.
Thank you, Governor Stevenson. Now, to continue our 20th anniversary roundtable discussion of national security and individual freedom, we hear Francis Biddle, formerly Attorney General of the United States. To present Mr. Biddle, we take you now to Washington.
Do not believe that keeping our country internally secure conflicts with the problem of individual freedom. On the contrary, respect for individual freedom is necessary if we are to sustain internal strength and unity. A regimented America, based on the worship of orthodoxy, is not a strong America. Spies are always a threat, particularly in times like these. We must be eternally vigilant to catch them. But spies are not caught by loyalty oaths and loyalty tests and requirements that communists register. Seth Richardson, the former chairman of the Federal Loyalty Review Board, testified before a Senate committee that the loyal investigations, and I quote his language, had not produced one single case of espionage or turned up any evidence directing towards espionage. Spies are caught by patient, quiet, persistent counter-espionage. This we have in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The men, chiefly politicians, who say that our public institutions are filled with communists are testifying falsely. Our public institutions are sound. Our public servants overwhelmingly are loyal. The constant attack on their loyalty has created an increasing distrust and disunity in the mind of the public. The obsession increases day by day. Fear of Russia and of war has now become fear of liberalism, fear of change, fear of independent thinking, fear, in fact, of being called communist. It finds expression in the strange procedures of the Un-American Activities Committee of the House and in similar committees of state legislatures. Teachers are investigated. The American Bar Association would have lawyers take test oaths. Jean Muir is dropped, though later reinstated, from her radio spot on unfounded charges. Pearl Buck and Marquis Childs are not allowed to speak at a public school in the District of Columbia. Attempts are made to smear Anna Rosenberg. McCarthyism, violent and obscurantist, takes hold. The big lies are reiterated until many believe them. Congress, on the eve of an election, hurries through the ill-considered and inept McCarran law, afraid to resist the spread of thought control. we seem to have forgotten the historical years that followed the First World War. The 2000 sedition trials, the infamous Palmer Raid, the application of guilt by association to the five socialists who were ousted from the New York Assembly over the passionate protest of Charles Evan Hughes, later Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Now there are but few protests, notably among them President Conant of Harvard, Chancellor Hutchins of the University of Chicago, and those scientists who have seen what all this is doing to the free exchange of scientific knowledge so essential to the growth and to the vitality of our technical equipment. Our freedom has made us great and strong. But Jefferson's philosophy is forgotten, forgotten his own full tide of successful experiment that had kept us free and firm, as he said, kept us the strongest government on earth. We no longer have that faith in ourselves, in our traditions of freedom. Liberty, wrote Walt Whitman, relies upon itself, invites no one, promises nothing, sits in calmness and light, is positive and composed, and knows no discouragement. When the laws of the free are grudgingly permitted, and laws for informers and spies are sweet to the taste of the people, then only shall the instinct of liberty be discharged from that part of the earth.
The program continues from Chicago.
Thank you, Mr. Biddle. You and Governor Stevenson have posed the problem of maintaining our internal security and yet preserving our traditional freedom. To discuss this problem, we now turn to Robert Carr, Executive Secretary of the President's Committee on Civil Rights and Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, and to Harold C. Urey, Nobel Prize-winning atomic scientist and Professor of Chemistry at the University of Chicago. Mr. Urey, are you worried about our security?
No. I believe the United States of America is a very, very strong position, much stronger than the various people that are discussing this subject would think. I believe that the future belongs to us, not the totalitarian governments. We are celebrating a 20th anniversary. I would like to look forward in discussing this problem to 20 or even 50 years ahead. The future belongs to the democratic free way of life, not to the totalitarian way of life.
Absolutely, Mr. Urey. I hope that throughout all of this discussion of our problem of security, we can remember that as a nation, we are strong and not weak. At the same time, we must be sure that in winning through over this period of 20 years or more, that we do not destroy the very thing we are fighting to save, our free way of life.
I agree. It is very well to look far ahead, as I think we should. But I think it is an excellent idea to remember that you accomplish a long objective only by looking after immediate details. And these immediate details should not be overlooked.
It might be well at the very beginning here to review briefly the present program which is being followed to assure loyalty and security and at the same time to maintain individual freedom. On the part of government, for example, we have the FBI, which is a detective agency, is seeking to enforce our traditional laws against espionage and sabotage. We've developed in the last two or three years an executive loyalty program which seeks to measure the loyalty of our federal employees. We have on our statute book such things as the Smith and McCarran Acts. We've had various prosecutions of individuals under these laws. We've had several congressional investigating committees, best known among which, of course, is the House Un-American Activities Committee.
As Mr. Biddle said, Mr. Carr, a moment ago, there have been a great many ways in which investigations of various kinds have also gone into our universities. Assuming that our universities are honeycombed with disloyal persons, something which has never been true in my experience, and, well, I have spent a very large fraction of my life in universities. We've also had the various red channels, these books that are published purporting to give us a list of all the communists in the United States, and listing among them quite prominent people. Does my memory deceive me? I think Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt was on one of these.
That's right.
These state-level investigations have also taken place during these last years, among the most notable of which is the investigation of the University of California by a legislative committee, or was it by its own board of trustees. We have had the demand for loyalty oaths on the part of universities, state employees, government employees, even county and city employees. All of these various things have been tried.
And now, of course, finally, we have the Nimitz Commission, a group of eminent private citizens set up as a presidential advisory body, and it must consider the basic problem of reconciling our liberty and our authority in the age in which we live. It must, of course, ask itself certain questions.